was not is not contemplated in the concept of bipolarity, or even in the notion of globalization as it was being considered in recent years.
Even America's close allies like the EU are engaged in free trade negotiations. Trump's protectionist agenda may eventually backfire, because as a growing number of countries sign free trade deals, American exporters may soon find themselves losing ground to international competitors. But who knows what direction America will take in the future? Trump will probably have to leave the White House in January, and that does not give him enough time to complete his America First project. The projected winner of the U.S. presidential election, Joe Biden, will face many dilemmas exactly because of Trump's controversial policies. Biden's presidency will probably mean a more traditional U.S. role on the world stage. He could bring back America from the brink of a full-blown trade and military conflict with China. But he cannot abruptly do away with Trump's protectionism to join free trade deals. Because right now, many Americans would see any such decision as throwing away U.S. jobs.
Top Iraqi military officials, including Defense Minister Lieutenant General Juma Anatsad Unkhattab, along with the Navy, Air Force, and Air Defense commanders, have visited the Iranian capital Tehran and met with high-ranking officials there. Chairman of the Chiefs of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, said the two sides discussed ways to reinforce defense and military cooperation. Bagheri further noted that during his meeting with the Iraqi defense minister, the two sides exchanged views on issues related to defense industry and security of the two countries' common borders, as well as bilateral cooperation and joint military exercises. The Iranian officials stressed the significance of boosting defense cooperation between the two neighbors, as the United States is after redeploying terrorists in the region.
A resurgence of terrorism in the region will help the United States to maintain its influence and to even infiltrate more than before in the region. And who is milking terrorist groups in the region in order to impose its will, in order to occupy, plunder, and change regimes?
The Iraqi defense chief also held talks with Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, on bilateral, regional, and international developments. Shamkhani said a U.S. objective is to create rifts and conflicts among regional states in West Asia, underlining the need for the regional countries to exercise vigilance against the sinister plot. Khattab, for his part, held Tehran's support and assistance for his country in repelling terrorism and stressed expanding bilateral relations, especially in military and security sectors. Calls for the ouster of foreign troops from the Iraqi soil strengthened following the U.S. assassination of top Iranian anti-terror commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and deputy head of Iraq's popular mobilization units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, near the Baghdad airport earlier this year. Following the attack, Iraqi lawmakers unanimously approved a bill demanding the withdrawal of all foreign forces from the country. Numerous rallies and protests have also been held across the country since with the same demands. The latest such demonstration was held last week near Baghdad's high-security green zone, where government buildings and foreign missions, including the U.S. Embassy, are located.
By assassinating the Iranian and Iraqi anti-terror heroes who literally liberated Iraq and Syria, from the terrorists of ISIS, the United States was fighting against the fight on terrors. And how could they sell their weapons? Warmongers in the United States sell their weapons and maintain their presence.
Washington has so far transferred several Iraqi military bases back to local forces, with senior U.S. military officials saying local forces are increasingly able to counter terrorism on their own. The head of the Pentagon Central Command said earlier this year that the number of U.S. troops in West Asia, including Iraq and Syria, would most likely be reduced soon. The commander, however, said he expected U.S. and NATO forces to maintain a long-term presence in Iraq to both help what he called fighting terrorism and checking Iranian influence in the country.
People have suffered enough, and in fact, they have demanded the United States presence termination. I think if the Iraqi government believes that they have democracy, that they have a system that can translate public opinion into laws and normatives, they should facilitate what the Iraqi parliament has already ratified.
But what has prompted the United States to reduce its troops in the region? Some experts say Trump wants to deliver his 2016 campaign promise of bringing back American forces from abroad. But others believe that Washington is losing its footprint in West Asia as calls for expelling U.S. forces by regional nations have grown stronger than ever.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. Today we're going to be looking at a problem which is very important, and that is the following question and problem. How can we reconcile the belief that God is the creator of all things with the idea, which we feel is intuitively true, that we are also agents of the effects that we intuitively feel stem from us? The belief that God is the creator of all things is a basic tenet of our faith and the faith of all religions. For example, in the Holy Quran, in Surah Ra'd, verse 16, God says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, قُلِ اللَّهُ خَالِقُ كُلِّ شَيْءٍ. God say that God is the creator of all things. It's very clear that the Quran is saying that God is the creator of all things. In other verses, we have something similar being expressed. For example, in Surah Zumar, verse 62, God says, Allahu khaliqu kulli shay. God is the creator of all things. In Surah Fatir, verse 3, God says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Ya ayyuhan nas, udhkuru ni'matullah alaykum, hal min khaliqin ghayrullah. This is addressed in the form of a question. which obviously seeks to negate the thing that God is asking about. Is there any creator for you besides God? The answer to the question is no. There is no creator besides God. At the same time, we feel that intuitively we know and we feel that we are the agent in the production of certain effects, and we act in this way. The question arises: how can we reconcile these two beliefs and these two propositions with one another without them contradicting one another? For certain individuals, this was a very difficult problem for the following reason. They said that once God creates something, once he grants existence to something, this thing becomes self-sufficient and no longer needs God in the continuation of its existence. Therefore, if we say that this thing in the continuation of its existence produces a certain effect, we can't say that God is the ultimate cause of that effect, right? Because in its subsistence and in the continuation of its existence, this thing no longer needs God. So we can't say that God is the cause of this thing, and this thing is the cause of and the agent of a certain effect. So ultimately, this effect is the product and the effect of God. No, because in the continuation of its existence, this thing becomes cut off from God. So for these people, these people were forced to say that God is the immediate creator of this effect. Obviously, because of that, they began fall into a precarious and difficult situation with respect to explaining free will. They explain it by saying that once a person makes the intention to perform a certain deed, God, looking at this intention, creates the effect within this person. This person is the recipient of this effect, not the agent of the effect. This is how they explained and tried to solve this problem and reconcile it with free will. However, the answer to this explanation is that this is wrong. We are of the opinion that even in the continuation of something's existence, this thing always needs God. It never becomes self-sufficient because poverty is something which is essential to God's creatures. In one of the verses of the Holy Quran, God says, "Ya yuhannas, antumul fuqara ilallah. Wallahu al-ghani." God is the being which is essentially self-sufficient. Beings other than him are not. They're essentially impoverished. They need God in the continuation of their existence, just like they need them in their genesis. Just like they need him in their genesis. So this resolution and answer is simply unacceptable. What is then is the acceptable resolution to this problem? We'll look at it, inshallah, in some of our forthcoming discussions. Until then, I'm Shiraz Aga. Thank you for joining us here once again on The Key. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Aga, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Round the world with reporters.
Capital Sana'a hosted the first scientific conference on cancerous diseases with a focus on gynecological cancers, attended by a large number of specialized doctors and academics under the sponsorship of the Yemeni Health Ministry.
We thought about enhancing the role of person, individual roles, community, families, communities, to be like sharing us our concern about their health, by educating them, by raising awareness about the signs and symptoms of cancers.
Since 2015, the number of cancer cases in Yemen has increased rapidly. According to the Undersecretary of the Health Ministry, Ali Jahath, he says this is due to the prohibited arms used by the U.S.-Saudi coalition over the past years.
That they have used forbidden armaments in bombing Yemen.
Yemeni army says it has discovered large quantities of U.S.-built munitions at the positions of Saudi mercenaries while conducting clean-up operations in the provinces of Marib and Al-Bayda. Saudi Arabia and a number of its regional allies launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015 in order to bring for Riyadh-friendly President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi back to power. Riyadh is the largest buyer of American-made weaponry. Trump signed an arms deal worth $110 billion with Saudi Arabia in May 2017. The Saudi military aggression against Yemen, coupled with a naval blockade, has killed hundreds of thousands of people and plunged Yemen into what UN says the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
Military camps have been set up to help overwhelmed reception facilities, but local authorities say the government is not doing enough. The island's president, Antonio Morales, has denounced what he calls the Ministry of Interior's continued contempt for migrants and the island, demanding the resignation of those responsible. Driven by economic hardship, around 17,000 migrants have arrived on the Canary Islands this year. According to Spain's Interior Ministry, that's a 1,000% increase from 2019. In 2019, 1,885 migrants drowned in the Mediterranean Sea, and 2020's death toll is fast approaching 1,000. Only last week, the Spanish Open Arms NGO reported six deaths after releasing this harrowing footage. Open Arms, the only NGO permitted to carry out search and rescue missions at present, wrote on Twitter, "Despite the enormous commitment of our medical team, a six-month-old baby has just died. We requested an urgent evacuation for him and other people in serious conditions, but he didn't make it. How much pain and sorrow." The International Criminal Court has sued the European Union, saying member states should be prosecuted for the deaths of thousands of migrants who have drowned in the Mediterranean. In its 245-page document, the ICC says the EU's deterrence-based migration policy, which came into force after 2014, sacrifices the lives of migrants in distress at sea to dissuade others from seeking a safe haven in Europe. Bianca Rahimi, London.
As the G20 summit is about to kick off in Saudi Arabia, Amnesty International is calling on the attendees of the meeting to take the kingdom to task for its appalling human rights record. The Crown had planned to promote its contentious reform agenda to the world and show Saudi Arabia is open for business. However, Riyadh summit will be solely held in the form of a virtual meeting due to the coronavirus restrictions. Amnesty International is urging G20 leaders to join the call for the immediate release of a number of jailed women's rights activists arrested in 2018.
What we said on the eve of the G20 is that Saudi Arabia's real change makers, the activists who spearheaded campaigns for women's rights, are in jail or facing trial. Riyadh is an inappropriate host.
Since assuming the G20 presidency in December last year, Riyadh has publicized new initiatives on women's employment opportunities, claiming that the kingdom is strongly committed to empowering women and girls.
On the occasion of the G20 summit, the Embassy of Saudi Arabia in Italy has organized a webinar on females' inclusion in society. Human rights groups have slammed these initiatives as mere attempts to reshape the kingdom's image through expensive PR campaigns, presenting Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman as a reformer.
The Crown has spent billions of dollars hosting major political, entertainment, cultural, and sporting events as a deliberate strategy to deflect from the country's image as a pervasive human rights violator, to whitewash its dismal rights record.
Saudi Arabia is using the G20 meeting in Riyadh to build legitimacy. Bear in mind that bin Salman is behind the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi and the Yemen war. The kingdom is cashing in on Donald Trump's staunch support all along the way.
Saudi Arabia is the first Arab nation to host the G20 summit, the meeting of the leaders of the world's most industrialized countries and emerging economies will be held on November 21st and 22nd, Max Civili, Rome.
A high-level conference focusing on the EU's treatment of refugees has just concluded in the European Parliament, Brussels. During the event, the 27-nation bloc's migration and asylum policy was slated. It appears a new crisis is emerging at sea as desperate African refugees try to reach EU territory.
Look what is already happening in the Atlantic. Hundreds of people are trying to reach the Canary Islands. Through the Atlantic, one of the most perilous routes in the world, they are dying there.
The EU unveiled a new asylum policy in September, but critics say the focus is on closing the bloc's borders instead of respecting international law and upholding the EU's much trumpeted values.
Our staff has spoken out against policies which are directly responsible for this unimaginable human suffering. Time and again, European nations and institutions have failed to act on their duty.
Many organizations insist the EU should be viewing immigration as an opportunity rather than a threat.
Behind all those people, there are hidden skills. We need to identify those skills and to use those skills in our European labor market.
The EU is paying billions of euro to Turkey and several African nations to try and prevent refugees from traveling. During the Brussels event, Ankara was accused of using the refugee crisis to advance geopolitical goals.
It is wrong to endorse the popular view of Turkey as a victim of the war in Syria. Turkey is on war in Syria since its very last start.
However, Ankara is highly critical of the European Union over its handling of the problem. Refugees continue to die in the Mediterranean. Those who make it are held in very poor conditions on Greek islands and now Spanish islands too. Perhaps the most compelling argument being made by rights groups for the EU to do more is because the West has fueled so much conflict in the Middle East and Africa, effectively playing a big role in helping to create the refugee crisis. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
There are claims of discrimination at this school that highlighted the entrenched racism which resides in the broader community here. Among the accounts, children of colour were described with highly derogatory terms by teachers and fellow learners, were excluded from certain activities. And when this was protested, white individuals from the area violently attacked those raising concerns. Protesters say by perpetuating this attitude, which is reminiscent of the apartheid years, youth born under South Africa's democracy are still being taught old racial tendencies.
That we are against the racism. We are not against the white people. You must be correct with that. We are not against with white people. They are humans like us. But the way they treat us, it's like we are not humans.
But today, as before, the police were clearly set to protect the white community, blocking all efforts by the protesters to make progress. Demonstrators point to a broader issue with how the government continues to target the vulnerable.
It was just a peaceful protest because no one did anything to harm the police. We're just peacefully and then raising our voices that enough is enough. So they started to do this thing because we are black.
This is an illusion of democracy that we are getting. It's just a democracy that we have received just only to vote. But in terms of freedom, we're not free.
Scenes of a riot that we have witnessed here in this area today. Stun grenades, rubber bullets, as well as water cannons used to disperse the crowd. And so they were prevented from handing over their memorandum of demands, which of course was against racism within this area. At this point, there appears little effort by authorities to make a move against racism here. The Provincial Education Department has rejected calls by the South African Human Rights Commission for a probe or any action against teachers accused of racism. The opposition, left-leaning economic freedom fighters, which has led these protests, say it is this attitude that will only ensure they continue with their protests. Hassan Siriop, Cape Town.
mainstream parties in the United States have been profoundly shaken by the election results from November 3rd. While the Democrats may prevail in the still disputed presidential election, their so-called blue wave has been universally described as an abject disaster. Despite unprecedented mainstream media support, widespread leftist-based protests, and record fundraising, they failed to retake the Senate, lost seats in the House, lost one governorship, and failed to flip a single state legislature. Because this is a census year, Republicans will control drawing up most of the decade's new electoral maps, causing many to say the election was a disastrous setback for progressive causes.
70% of Republicans, 90% of Democratic voters, are for Medicare for All. They're for the ending of student debt. They're for a UBI to sustain them, especially during COVID. So these things are very progressive, and the Democrats were against them.
Massive infighting among the party elite is being reported. Older and moderate Democrats blame newly popular progressive causes for the losses, but the Democratic Socialists of America, the left wing of the Democratic Party, won 70% of the races and ballot initiatives they endorsed.
The Democrats really aren't progressive. I would attribute their losses to putting up bad candidates, candidates that are very centrist. So this is the strategy of the Democrats, is we need to be more centrist or more rightist centrist, and they'll blame progressives.
The election results were widely expected to be a repudiation of so-called Trumpism, but analysts say they actually cemented the unprecedented political uprising unexpectedly led by Donald Trump. So-called Trumpian Republicans are now expected to reshape the conservative party. There seems to be unanimous agreement that regardless of the final outcome of the presidential election, Trump and his family will have increased, not decreased, control over the Republican Party. A pre-election poll asked Republicans and Republican-leaning independents if they considered themselves a supporter of Trump or a supporter of the Republican Party. 60% picked Trump. Whichever presidential candidate is finally inaugurated, it seems certain that America has undergone a dramatic political shift, which few people predicted and which many are struggling to understand and accept. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Sheikh Zaza King's trial continued in a Kaduna State High Court in northern Nigeria with the presentation of two prosecution witnesses. The two witnesses were officers of the Nigerian Army who made their presentations in court while journalists stay outside.
They gave evidence about the operation, of the military operation that lasted between the 12th and the 14th of December 2015, and the role played by each of them. We just want to see how far we can go tomorrow. The prosecution is not likely to close the case tomorrow. So we'll then take other days so that we can speedily, have this matter concluded.
Sheikh Ibrahim Zazaki is being tried for culpable homicide, unlawful assembly, disruption of public peace, among other allegations, which the Islamic movement has described as fabricated and baseless. In December 2015, soldiers of the Nigerian army attacked Zazaki's home and worship center, killing over 340 of his supporters. No soldier has been charged for the mass murders of Zazaki's supporters, despite the recommendation of a judicial commission of inquiry set up by the Kaduna State government. Sheikh Zazaki has been in detention for close to 5 years in violation of the ruling of a federal high court ordering for his release.
The Nigerian judiciary is a very independent judiciary. So by the grace of Allah, there is going to be a way out for Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki, in as much as the Nigerian judiciary remain independent. Definitely there is going to be a way out for Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki through the constitutional means.
Despite being a public trial, no journalist or any member of the Zazaki family has ever been allowed inside the courtroom. Meanwhile, Zazaki supporters have continued to demand for his release in accordance with the order of a federal high court in Abuja.
Benjamin Abdullahi, Abuja.
Former U.S. Vice President Joe Biden has been projected the winner in the disputed U.S. presidential vote. That means in about 2 months, Donald Trump will have to hand in power to Biden. His administration, however, is using every opportunity to take controversial steps. On Thursday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo paid a visit to an Israeli settlement in the occupied West Bank to further consolidate Israel's occupation of Palestinian lands.
During the Trump administration, America stands with Israel like never before. Indeed, the commitment we've made, the ironclad commitment we've made to the Jewish state, will continue.
Pompeo said the U.S. will label the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign as anti-Semitic and cancerous. He said Washington will require that imports from Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank be labeled as made in Israel. In 2016, the United Nations Security Council adopted a resolution to reaffirm the illegality of Israeli settlements. Referring to Israelis as an occupying power, the resolution called on Israel to stop settlement constructions and abide by its obligations under international law. Later in the day, Mike Pompeo also visited the occupied Golan Heights, which Israel seized from Syria in a 1967 war. President Trump recognized Israel's sovereignty over the region last year. Pompeo's Thursday visits drew the ire of the Palestinians. A spokesman for Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas slammed the U.S. labeling move as a violation of international law. Also, senior member of the Palestine Liberation Organization, Wasil Abu Youssef, said Pompeo's labeling announcement, quote, reaffirms the partnership between U.S. President Trump and the occupation. Another senior PLO member, Hanan Ashrawi, said Mike Pompeo's visit is aimed at setting another illegal precedent. Pompeo's visits to an Israeli settlement and the occupied Golan Heights were controversial enough. However, they are dwarfed by other anti-Palestinian moves taken by the Trump administration in the past 4 years. Trump announced Jerusalem al-Quds as the capital of Israel. Palestinians say the city belongs to them and is the capital of their state. Trump also relocated the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to al-Quds. The American president also showed unprecedented support for Israeli crimes, including bombardment of the Gaza Strip and killing of Palestinians across the occupied territories, setting new precedents in Washington's deep-seated and biased support for the Israeli occupation and crimes against Palestinians.
Millions of businesses across the EU's 27 member states remain closed due to COVID-19. Retail, hospitality, and aviation sectors have been decimated by the pandemic.
People who never were really in the risk of poverty are now really at the risk of poverty. They are now queuing up for food aid.
The European Commission has just published its EU Economic Semester Report 2021, and things are not looking good.
We will have an incomplete and uneven recovery over the coming 2 years, and with persistent uncertainty and multiple risks.
The Commission's report highlights how a debt mountain is growing in the EU, particularly in key nations such as Italy and France. Lobby groups are questioning whether financial support packages already announced will be sufficient.
Is it going to start a new growth for Europe and employment for Europe? We are not sure either. So it's a lot of promise. They have to deliver, because otherwise people will be so disappointed and the trust will completely disappear.
The EU is experiencing its sharpest ever decline in employment due to the pandemic, and things were certainly not perfect even before COVID-19. The European Commission says political leaders across the bloc must take decisive action to prevent social catastrophe.
We need a quick agreement on all elements of EU's 1.82 trillion euros recovery package to support the real economy. People and businesses are waiting.
The EU Commission says 4.1 million temporary jobs have been lost in the bloc. Young adults have been impacted most severely.
Suicide rates in the EU are on the up. Therefore, social rights groups say the need for governments to agree on financial support is not just about the economy. It is, in fact, a matter of life and death. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
coronavirus infections among the general population are rapidly rising in the Gaza Strip, with nearly 500 cases being discovered on a daily basis. On Wednesday, 4 deaths were reported and 600 infections were detected, bringing the number of infections to over 12,000. Hospitals in Gaza, meanwhile, are running low on intensive care units and ventilators, as well as medicines and equipment. During a press conference, the Ministry of Interior in Gaza raised the alarm over the rising number of infections.
The Ministry of Interior may be forced to take some extreme and tough measures, including a full lockdown given the high number of daily infections. Today, the rate of infections has increased more than 20% compared with only 5% during the first weeks of the spread of the deadly virus.
Due to the Israeli blockade, nearly 2 million Gazans are under terrible strain, and their worries over the coronavirus have been heavily compounded.
The rapid rise in the number of infections is frightening. Given the current circumstances, we are praying for a miracle to keep us safe during this deadly pandemic.
The blockade has destroyed our economy, and a full lockdown will be catastrophic. I think a partial lockdown is better so that people can make a living amid the dire economic situation.
The coronavirus spread among the general population has taken its toll on the impoverished coastal sliver. A full lockdown was imposed on the Gaza Strip in late August for a period of 2 weeks after authorities confirmed the first coronavirus cases spread through the community.
During the full lockdown, factories and businesses were completely closed, inflicting a heavy blow on the economic sector of the enclave, which has been battered by the Israeli blockade. All institutions, including civil society organizations, are suffering from lack of funding as poverty and unemployment rates increasing rapidly.
The coronavirus continues to threaten the socioeconomic welfare of Palestinians living in Gaza as much as their health.
People here are bracing themselves for the worst as coronavirus infections continue to increase at a fast pace amid the crippling Israeli blockade. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Rich countries accused of hoarding future vaccines are being urged to support a humanitarian buffer to inoculate refugees and people in conflict zones, says Brett Wilkins-Ryder in an article published under the heading, "By rejecting WTO drug patent waivers amid pandemic, richest nations put big pharma profits before health of billions." Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. A handful of the world's wealthiest nations on Friday, November 20th, dug in their heels in their fight against waiving intellectual property rules for COVID-19 vaccines and treatments, putting them even more firmly at odds with global health campaigners struggling to ensure access for people in developing countries, conflict zones, and refugee camps. The United States, European Union, United Kingdom, Canada, and Australia all opposed intellectual property waivers at a Friday meeting of the World Trade Organization, WTO, in Geneva. Such waivers would allow mass production of life-saving advances in a move campaigners say could shorten the peaking pandemic. Seeking to avoid the type of tragedy the world witnessed a generation ago when hundreds of thousands of people in poor countries died from AIDS because they couldn't afford HIV medications, Kenya on Friday, November 20th, formally asked the WTO to suspend patents for certain COVID-19 treatments. Last month, India and South Africa were the first countries to propose granting permission to WTO members to temporarily waive patents and other protections on all COVID-19 related vaccines and treatments until the end of the pandemic. Since then, China, which according to Reuters has 5 COVID-19 vaccine candidates in later stage trials, has voiced support for the waivers. Dozens of mostly developing nations also back waivers, as do over 100 civil society groups in Europe who have signed an open letter sent to EU leaders recently supporting the suspension policy. Rich countries have come under fire for cornering the supply of future COVID-19 vaccines. In September, wealthy countries with just 13% of the world's population had already purchased rights to more than half of all promised vaccine doses. And last week, Common Dreams reported that 82% of doses of Pfizer's forthcoming vaccine had been bought up by rich nations. Compounding the injustice, say campaigners, is the unprecedented amount of taxpayer funding pharmaceutical companies have received to develop vaccines. According to the France-based medical charity Médecins Sans Frontières, MSF, although Pfizer, BioNTech, Moderna, and AstraZeneca, Oxford University, have taken a combined $6.68 billion in public funding for their vaccine candidates, the corporations have retained control over key decisions, including who gets the vaccines, when they get them, how much they get, and how much they pay. Consumer advocates have warned that Big Pharma is having it both ways by taking huge amounts of taxpayer funding to develop treatments that they will then sell back to the public at prodigious profits. Earlier this year, Moderna was accused of taking taxpayers for a ride after it announced that it plans to charge between $32 and $37 per dose for a COVID-19 vaccine developed entirely with U.S. government funding. As the rollout of effective COVID-19 vaccines draws near, calls for a people's vaccine grow louder. Responding to news recently that Pfizer vaccine candidate has been deemed over 90% effective and could soon be available, Heidi Cho, a pharmaceuticals campaigner at the advocacy group Global Justice Now, asserted that the company must share this vaccine with the world, not hoard it for profit. That should mean putting it into the World Health Organization's global pool so that the technological know-how and patent rights are shared to enable multiple manufacturers to produce it as fast as possible, said Cho. But since they won't, the WTO needs to act to suspend patents on all COVID-19 medicines, as South Africa and India have proposed. This is a race against time, and we cannot allow the pursuit of profits to triumph over human need, Cho added. The need is acute in war and conflict zones and camps for refugees and other displaced people. Public health advocates are hard at work lobbying rich countries to commit to reserving a portion of their COVID-19 vaccine stockpiles to form a humanitarian buffer to inoculate those who most need help. In Syria, for example, there are a lot of internally displaced people. MSF vaccine pharmacist Alan Al-Salhani told The Guardian.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the documentary, we went to Singapore, an island city state off southern Malaysia, where 5.2 million people call home. Singapore is a global financial center where one in four have a university degree and 90% own a home. By all counts, Singapore is prosperous, rich, and safe. But this is not the whole story. A 2010 survey shockingly revealed that over 9% of women in Singapore experience physical or sexual abuse from their partners, and one-third of these domestic violence victims have a college degree. We followed the stories of Rachel, Mira, and Vu as they shared their experiences of abuse, victimization, and shame. But as bad as violence and abuse is for any woman, and the situation is much worse for women who are migrants living in a foreign country, as we shall see in the rest of the program.
In 1994, Vu met and married her Singaporean husband in Ho Chi Minh City. She was 21 and he was 41. Shortly after, Vu and her husband returned to Vietnam so that her family could help look after the baby. This was when his true nature was exposed. Hoping for a better education for her daughter, Vu agreed to move back to Singapore. That was 15 years ago. Vu's husband's addiction to gambling often led to fights, but she learned to hit back. Although she could defend herself physically, he had other ways of punishing her. To remain in Singapore, Vu required a long-term social visit pass, which was renewed yearly. This visa requires a guarantor, her husband.
The law recognizes that when someone hurts you physically, threatens you, confines you, harasses you, then that's a violation of your rights. The law does not state that even someone abuses you verbally, emotionally, that's a violation of your rights. And so protection under the law may not be extended to the individual under those circumstances. But does it make it right? Of course not.
For the first few years, Ru was financially dependent on her husband and mother-in-law, but she slowly worked her way to independence. To make ends meet, she sold donated clothes at the Sungai Road street market. For the past 4 years, Ru has held a stable job at a fast food restaurant. With help from charities and aid agencies, her children's education is paid for. She is the breadwinner now, but her husband still holds some of the cards. Ru wants to leave her husband, but first, she needs to make sure that her right to reside in Singapore is secure. In 2 years, Ru's daughter will be 21, the required age to become her mother's guarantor in Singapore. It's the promise of the life that comes after that keeps Ru going day by day. Whether or not her dream can become reality remains to be seen.
Some foreign spouses will find it difficult to get citizenship or PR because they don't have a lot of education and also are married to men who themselves don't have a lot of education, lowly skilled, and they are seen as not being able to contribute that significantly to the Singapore economy. Because our immigration policy is very much tied to one's economic or potential economic contribution, the chances of getting the PR or citizenship are not so high. I think the immigration policy should definitely be reviewed. One, there should be some criteria so that foreign spouses can work towards making sure that in time they can actually acquire citizenship. Two, there should be some points given, you know, and a lot of points given for the fact that they have children in Singapore. And if the children are Singapore citizens, it really doesn't help the family that their mother has got such a uncertain citizenship status.
Victims of domestic violence transcend race, income, and educational background. One in three victims in Singapore have a university degree, and they are even more likely to stay silent.
There's a lot of victim blaming still going on, you know, and the very fact that people still think that, you know, I'm washing dirty linen, you know, in public when I talk about these things, you know.
Why have we still not come to a point in society where people are willing to intervene?
It's a private matter between a husband and a wife. You should not interfere.
That domestic violence is a private matter.
We don't know all the facts. There's another side of the story.
I think the reason that that's so difficult, and I think you hit on two things that are really important that I think are sorely lacking right now in our society, which are one, empathy, and two, imagination. Mm-hmm. And in Singapore, these are two qualities that are not at all considered to be that important.
Once there were only two. Then it became four. Soon there will be six universities in Singapore. And more than 48% of university graduates are women. Both Rachel and Mira are professionals in the marketing industry. And like many other successful women, they have struggled with the issue of shame.
I didn't want people to know that, you know, I was like one of the statistics, you know, abused wife, and then, you know, the pity, and then, you know, the whispering, the gossiping and all that. I really didn't want any of that. So I very stupidly, you know, just kept it to myself. I didn't say anything. I just put it all upon myself, you know, to try to solve the problem.
I didn't want my family to feel that I've married a terrible person, nothing. I wanted him to be respected. I didn't want to go to my family and say, this is what my husband is doing to me.
According to the International Violence Against Women survey in 2010, almost one in three victims in Singapore have a degree or postgraduate credentials.
The fact that we found a disproportionately higher number of women who were victims of violence who had university or postgraduate qualifications hammers home the point that education alone is not enough. We have done well economically. We have done well in terms of, you know, earning capacity. But in terms of how we are as a society, our values, what we see as important, perhaps there's a lot more room for improvement.
Why did these professional women stay silent?
So educated women will feel that they should be able to handle anything that happens in their family, right, including violence. And so they are not going to readily tell another party. In fact, they often try to deal with it themselves, and they are less likely to tell their friend or family member because they're much more embarrassed.
It's not just got to do with the income and the education, but really a lot has got to do also with the beliefs that we hold.
Shame, embarrassment, saving the family honor.
Perhaps it has something to do with the fact that when I think about drawing attention to my problems, I draw attention to not just shaming me as a person, but shaming my family, my community.
But if victims remain silent, do family and friends have the responsibility to speak out? That is Robert's dilemma. He has known Luke and Lena for 30 years.
I actually did not believe that he would do such a thing. So when she told me about it, she said, I don't think I want to be with him. So I told her, well, give yourself a bit of time, think about it.
Robert never imagined that his friend could be a wife beater.
We always tell him, if you've got a good wife, then just, you know, control yourself. Oh no, I love my wife. I love my wife very much. I will not do such a thing. But we can see, you know, a few times when myself and my spouse met this couple, we could see on her face black and blue marks hidden under the makeup.
When Robert accepted that his friend Luke was an abusive husband, he offered help.
I tried to help her by asking her if she needs any, advice from lawyers, if she needs to get away from him. You know, we could help her find a place.
But fear has kept Lena under her own roof.
If she were to leave him, she thinks that she will lose whatever she's put into the home. And she may lose her son also.
Family violence professionals believe that the community has a larger role to play.
Violence will only stop if the society actually is more proactive, because it is really the people around the victim that have much more choices than the victim, much more choices to do something about the problem.
For most people, the hardest part is knowing when to take action and how far to go.
I have this fear factor in me that what happens in their home behind closed doors is very private. And the fear is, if I were to actually interfere in their private affairs, it may backfire. So either party has to make the first step.
Without an explicit cry for help, Robert feels he cannot act further.
If she comes to me physically and say, look, this is what has happened to me, with all the bruises and all the black and blue marks on her face or arms, I would personally think that I will bring her to a police station to make a report. But she has never at one time said, yes, help me, or I will follow your advice. So I'm in a very difficult position to report this matter to the authorities.
When is the right time to act?
There's something called the battered wife syndrome, and there are people who have been in victim mentality for many, many years, right? And the children see it, right? But are powerless, right? And so I think in some cases, you actually need to allow people like their children or even social workers to help them take that first step and to initiate the process, because otherwise they will continue to be in this situation.
Now that her son is about close to 30 years old, is still single, she did bring this subject up to him and ask him that she told